call our last case for today, 2012 AP 1493, John Christ versus ExxonMobil Corporation. Arguing on behalf of ExxonMobil Corporation et al. Is Dennis M. Sullivan. 25 minutes, Matthew Biegert. 30 minutes on behalf of Donald Christ et al. And then Mr. Sullivan, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. You may proceed.
It's Abramson. May it please the Court. My name is Dennis Sullivan, and I'm pleased to appear before you today and represent the defendants in this action. I'm unfortunately suffering a bit with a cold, so my words may be limited today, which could be an advantage all the way around. The only question before the Court today is a fairly simple one, straightforward, which is, can the discovery rule, which was described by this Court in Hansen versus A.H. Robbins, be applied to third parties? In other words, can someone other than the injured person discover the injury, its cause, and the potential defendants for the purposes of establishing an accrual date for the injured person? Now, in looking at the Court's synopsis today, I can see that I want to make sure that there is no misunderstanding at the outset. And that is, we are not saying, and we've never said, that the discovery rule does not apply in this case.
Counselor, we don't write those things that are printed out there on our website and are distributed before oral arguments, just to give the public some idea of what might be talked about, so don't let that concern you.
Okay.
Well, some of us read them, so you better tell us.
Yeah. I will. We've never said that the discovery rule does not apply in this case. What we have said is that the discovery rule only applies to the injured person, and in these situations, these are wrongful death and survival claims, and so the discovery rule only applies to the decedents. That is, only the decedents can discover their injury, the cause, and the potential defendants, and that no third parties, such as wrongful death beneficiaries, special administrators, heirs, or other interested parties, can discover that claim and establish an accrual date for the underlying claim.
So the last possible accrual date is the date of death?
Correct.
Yeah. Okay.
So the
this for both survival and wrongful death.
Exactly. So the
and these causes of action were brought more than 3 years after that?
After death, correct.
Okay.
And so the accrual date is, as the Court has noted, and as the Court of Appeals noted in Merrill, the State of Merrill versus Jarek.
Let's take a look at that case, because the specific language that you've referenced in your brief regarding Merrill, in the paragraph, I note that the paragraph indicates, in that one car accident, whether he was a guest passenger, that the accrual date was the date of death. You know, the injury, you knew what the injury was, you knew the causation. But we have a way of writing generally, or I do and many others do, that when the holding is narrow based on the facts, we insert the word here. You know, and that word is inserted there. But that's the paragraph that you rely on. And as soon as I read the case and then saw the word here, it was clear to me that, in my reading of it anyway, others may see it differently, that it was, given the facts presented, that the accrual date was the date of death, that it was a one-car accident, guest passenger case.
Excuse me, Justice Bradley, can you tell me what paragraph you're looking at so I can follow along?
Well, let me see from my notes.
I was looking at Meryl. I'm sorry if there's
yeah,
no.
Let me see from my notes and let me see from my eyes. I do a lot of writing on the margins. Let me see. Do you know what paragraph I'm referring to?
Offhand.
It's right
on.
It's one that you've referred to several times in your brief.
Doesn't have it memorized.
Maybe it's on page 18 of your brief. Let's just take a look.
It's the red brief?
Yeah, the red brief.
I'm not sure, but let me see if it is there, because that's one place we've mentioned, Meryl. No, it's not jumping out at me.
Well, I'm not sure, Your Honor, if this is it's the last paragraph in the Merrill case, I think.
Okay.
Where, you have a paragraph number on it.
18? Looks like paragraph 18.
Okay.
And the important thing about Merrill is that the Court of Appeals there did not decide when the date of accrual was. The important thing about Merrill is that the Court of Appeals stated that the date of accrual is when the decedent discovered or should have discovered their claim, no later than the date of death. So the Court of Appeals sent it back to the trial court for the purposes of determining whether or not Sean Merrill had discovered that claim before his death, because there was some evidence presented in the circuit court that he was conscious after the accident and that, at least according to Mr. Jarek, who was in the car with him, he was aware of his situation. And so the Court of Appeals said, and it's important, too, I think, that the defendants in that case were advocating that the date of accrual was the date that the parents, the personal representatives of Sean Merrill, the date that they discovered that claim, which was the date of the accident, because they had settled the wrongful death claim years before. And so the only question that was presented in that particular case was a survival claim. So the Court of Appeals sent it back and said that the focus is not on the parents, it's not on the personal representatives, it's not on anybody else, it's on Sean Merrill.
That's because the survival claim is one that takes the shoes of the decedent, right?
Exactly.
Okay. But it is paragraph 18. And the holding in paragraph 18, you know, it is kind of amazing. Usually we have the holdings towards the end. It is the last paragraph. I should have gone there first. We conclude that the estate survival claim accrued when Merrill, with reasonable diligence, that's the kind of language that we see, of course, from Hansen, should have discovered his claim. Here, that means, under the facts of this case, no later than his date of death than his claim vested with the estate's personal representative. The argument is advanced, and there's a compelling nature to the argument that given the fact that it is a one-car accident and the test set forth in Hansen, you have to know what the injury is. We know what the injury is here. There's no doubt about that. We have to know the, if you will, the causation, and we have to know the tortfeasor. I mean, those are the things we have to know under Hansen, and all of those things were available on the date of death.
Well, they were available well before the date of death, and that's what the defendants in that case were saying. All of that information was available to the parents on the date of the accident. So the defendants in that case were saying that the defendants in that case were taking the position that the plaintiffs in this case are taking, which is the focus is on the parents. What they knew, the personal representatives, the special administrators, what they knew, and they knew that on the date of the accident.
Well, they didn't know what their claim was. They didn't know how long they're going to live. The survival claim is for pain and suffering, and they don't know how long their pain and suffering is going to be on the day of the accident. I mean, they could have because he could have lived for 3 months or 3 days. Here we have 3 days in Merrill. So
that would be a question of what are the damages, not whether or not there's a claim.
And well, don't you have to, under Hansen, know the injury, when the injury was known to you?
But absolutely, and the injury certainly was known. He was unconscious in the hospital. He was near death, and he died 3 days later. So the Court of Appeals there, the important thing about Merrill is that the Court of Appeals kept the focus on the person who was injured, which had been the practice of this court and the Court of Appeals in every case that applied the discovery rule up until Merrill.
What about this? Keeping the focus on the in a survivor on the decedent and what the decedent knew or with reasonable diligence should have known. Is part of our jurisprudence with this phrase, should have known had the decedent lived. In other words, let's take cases that we have here or something similar to that, that it is a latent kind of disease, and the person died, and it wasn't until 4 years later that some kind of causation could have really been connected. Is our jurisprudence such that the question is what the decedent should have known or should have discovered had the decedent lived?
I don't think so. And the reason is this, because the only alternative to keeping the focus on the decedent is to expand it to a universe of people who is potentially limitless. And this comes back to Hansen, and that Hansen, the court in Hansen, was very careful to say that they were departing from the sort of the traditional rule of setting the date of accrual on the date of injury and expanding it to the date of discovery, but they were not disposing of the concerns, the legitimate concerns about the all of the issues that come up in a statute of limitations case, loss of evidence, loss of witnesses, faded memories. And so the court in Hansen insisted and made a condition of applying the discovery rule that the plaintiff exercise diligence. And as this court has said in subsequent cases, that includes a duty to investigate. So the question that you present, Justice Bradley, the option then is to open up to the universe of just about anybody of potential plaintiffs. And so then the question is, all right, how do we measure their reasonable diligence? Now, this was specifically addressed in Hansen. Kathy Hansen had gone to the doctor. She'd gone to two doctors. And it wasn't until some time after she had been doing all of her work to try to figure out why she was experiencing these symptoms that it was discovered that the IUD needed to come out and that was the cause of her problems. So the court there said she had exercised reasonable diligence. It's an objective standard, and she met that standard. Same thing came up then in Borrello. Mrs. Borrello gets sick. Even though she suspected the furnace was the cause of her injury, she didn't really know that. She had been kind of sidetracked with some opinions of different doctors. But she was diligent. And her diligence was traced by this court and demonstrated that she had done everything that she needed to do to try to find out what was the cause of her injury.
Now,
if we expand that to third parties, and we know from Carlson versus Pepin County that the examination is from the perspective of the plaintiff. In other words, reasonable diligence is examined from the perspective of the plaintiff.
Are you advancing that for both the survivor claim and the wrongful death claim?
Well, that was the ruling in Carlson versus Pepin County. And so if that's the case, if we're going to be looking at what is reasonable diligence from the perspective of the plaintiff, and now if the plaintiff could be an heir, Uncle John, who lives 1,000 miles away, who may have no basis, no reason to investigate the cause of the decedent's injury, anything like that, when you look at it from that person's perspective, what is reasonable diligence? Uncle John's going to say, well, I had no idea. Well, of course you didn't. And there was no reason for you to be investigating, doing anything to try to investigate what is the cause of this injury. And so reasonable diligence at that point is meaningless. And it completely distorts this court's ruling in Hansen. And it takes away the objective, one of the objectives that this court set down in Hansen, which is to have an even-handed application of that discovery rule and to make sure that it was only going to be exercised by those who were diligent in investigating their injury, the cause of the injury, and the potential defendants.
Mr. Sullivan, can't there be situations where there is no possibility of measuring reasonable diligence? I'm thinking about a person who's seriously injured in an accident, is in a coma. How do you measure reasonable diligence under those circumstances?
All right, and that is exactly the situation that came up in the Washington case, which was cited by the court in Merrill. In that case, Mrs. Washington had been given an anesthetic during childbirth. She went into a coma and died 14 years later. Her husband then brought a claim, and initially it was dismissed because, according to the district court, the claim had expired, the statute of limitations had expired, because Mr. Washington, the plaintiff, knew back at the 14 years ago what the problem was, that there was an injury and what the cause of the injury was and all the rest of that. The Ninth Circuit, looking at that, said, no, we do measure it from the perspective of the injured person, but if that person cannot discover their injury and later dies, then the action accrues at the time of death. And consequently, Mr. Washington's claim was allowed to proceed. And so the important thing, I think, for this case is if the rule that's being advocated by the plaintiffs here and by the Court of Appeals, apparently, had applied, Mrs. Washington's heirs, her beneficiaries, would be out of luck because her husband knew 14 years ago of what the problem was. And this was also, and we cited other cases, the Advicula, I'm not sure exactly how to pronounce it, but there's a case from Illinois appellate court where the man was given a tainted blood transfusion, developed AIDS, and later died. His wife sought to bring a claim after death, and the defendants there said, no, statute of limitations has expired because you, Mrs. Advincula, you knew back at the time what the problem was and all the rest of that, and that was the date that your action accrued. The Illinois appellate court said no. The action accrued when the injured person discovered that claim, and so that is the date. So the focus has been always on, well, I shouldn't say always. There are other cases that go the other way. But it's a good example of why it's important to keep the focus on the injured person and the problems that will occur, inevitably occur, in expanding it to third parties. I think that the question of reasonable diligence become the condition of reasonable diligence becomes meaningless if it is expanded to the universe of potential people who could bring a claim for wrongful death or a survival claim. Any heir, any interested person could bring that claim, and as we pointed out in our brief, the potential for mischief certainly exists there by selecting somebody who could best fit the conditions to demonstrate that reasonable diligence had been exercised and that no reasonable diligence was, in fact, reasonable diligence. In my judgment, Justice Crooks, if that's the rule, that no reasonable diligence can be reasonable diligence, the rule has become meaningless, and that condition that was established in Hansen has gone away.
It appears to me that the majority of jurisdictions disagree with your argument here. I look to page 15, I think it is, of the blue brief, and they set forth the case in Delaware that did some of the work for me. That is on page 16, I guess. They start the discussion on 15, and the DiMedio case from Delaware then set forth, and that was, I think, a 1986 case. At that time, there were, maybe eight jurisdictions that would be not siding with you, and five would side with you. But I think if you updated this, there are more jurisdictions that would be against you. So, you know, how do you respond to that vis-a-vis your kind of sky is falling case? Are these now 11 or 12 states going to fall off the end of the
map? Justice Brantley, I don't think that's correct. I don't think that a majority of states go in the direction that you're saying. I think that a majority of states go the other direction. But here is the problem with sort of looking at the universe.
Before you depart from that, I used as the threshold the cases set forth on page 16 and then had some additional research done. What are you relying on for your assertion that the majority of jurisdictions are in your accord?
The main case that is relied upon for the proposition that you're describing is the White case from the state of Washington. That case relied heavily on two cases.
Let me just interject. I haven't read that case, so I apologize. But what I'm looking for sometimes is this kind of assist from other courts when they've already done the division for me and all I have to do is update it. Does that case, the White case, have the jurisdictions that are in accord with you and the jurisdictions that are against you as of the date of the White case? Is there a listing as there is on page 16 of the blue brief from the DiMedio case?
They do describe a number of cases, but here is the problem, that the way wrongful death and survival claims are handled in all of the 50 states varies dramatically. And it is very, very difficult, unless you go back, look at the statute in each particular case to see exactly what they're talking about, to know whether or not the holding in that particular case is unique to that state or whether it does have some broader application. And, I mean, I've tried to do that. I mean, and it's difficult. And I don't think that it's really necessary because the jurisprudence that we are relying on is right here in the state of Wisconsin. The important thing I was going to say about White is White relied on two cases, one, a Northern District of Illinois case, federal district court, which opined as to what the state of Illinois would do if confronted with this question. State of Illinois appellate courts have said, both in the Advincula case that we were talking about and the Gale case, which I've cited in, I believe, in our reply brief, that no, the focus in this kind of a situation is on the injured person, the decedent. It is not expanded to anybody else. The other case that White relied on was a case from Pennsylvania, Pasternak, or something like that, a court of appeals case, that was later reversed by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. So I think that tracing and trying to find some explanation for the different holdings is very difficult. And the other thing is that
Let me just ask, is the Northern District of Illinois case the Eisenman case
Correct.
That you referenced?
Correct.
Because your opposing counsel says that's contrary, and we'll ask your opposing counsel on page 21. He says application of the discovery rule to survival actions also finds support in Eisenman, Northern District of Illinois.
Right, and we know that the Northern District doesn't speak for the state of Illinois. The Illinois appellate courts do, and we've cited both of the cases from the Illinois appellate courts that say just the opposite. And in Eisenman, the judge there even acknowledged that his decision was different than other Northern District of Illinois judges who had addressed the same issue, but he was going in a different direction. So I would say that case is out of tune.
Thank you.
My light
Thank
is
you,
on.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Matthew Biegert, representing plaintiff appellant cross-respondent Donald Crist et al.
Chief Justice, Justices, Counsel, may it please the Court. Let me jump right away to what the rule is currently. And the rule currently stated is that if an individual discovers their claim while they are still alive, the date of discovery acts as the accrual date. If the individual does not discover their claim, or while the individual is still alive, the knowledge of their family members is irrelevant. And the reason is, and you have a number
of... Knowledge of the family members is what?
Irrelevant. And the reason is because they don't have a claim capable of present enforcement, and that is why you see cases like the Advincula case, the Washington case, the Santos case that they cite, where you have a family member finds out, but because the injured person is under a disability or for a reason like that, the family member knows before the individual. In those cases, say, during that individual's lifetime, it is the knowledge of the individual, the injured party, that is relevant, not the knowledge of the family member. Then you get death. And upon death, at that point, the knowledge of the family members becomes relevant. If the individual died knowing of their claim, then that claim needs to be brought within 3 years of the date of discovery or 1 year from the date of death, whichever period is greater. I say that knowing that the Merrill case is a court of appeals case, and this court could theoretically decide that for non-medical negligence wrongful death claims, the date of death is the accrual date. But Merrill holds that the date of injury is the accrual date if discovery is not an issue, if that injured party knew about the claim while they were still alive. If the decedent dies not having discovered his or her claim, that claim accrues when it is discovered by an heir or beneficiary capable of bringing the claim. Mr. Sullivan and the defendants argue that that opens up a great wide world of potential claimants, and we're going to have to look at what was relevant in terms of their actions for discovery. It is not. Because what the Lord case says, which is cited in both of us briefs, is that at the time of death, you look at two things. With respect to specific statutorily designated wrongful death defendants, their individual actions and knowledge is relevant. And in the Lord case, they were minors, so they were under a disability, so the wrongful death case did not immediately accrue, or the statute of limitations did not come running upon the death of their parent. However, it said with respect to the estate is not an individual. The estate is not Uncle Joe out in California. And to the extent the estate has claims, we are going to look at those under an objective standard. And we are not going to look at every Tom, Dick, or Harry that may have a peripheral relationship. We're going to look at what a reasonable person, knowing they were in the position of managing the estate of this person, would have done. So the universe of people that you need to look at are statutory wrongful death beneficiaries, which are limited in Wisconsin as they aren't in some other states, and the estate, which is judged under an objective standard of what a reasonable person in charge of that estate would have done.
Is this for survival or wrongful death?
For wrongful death, you would look at the wrongful death beneficiaries, statutory. For the survival claim, you would look at the estate as an entity. Once that is done under Wisconsin law, to the extent that this rule works any substantive unfairness on any particular defendant, they can come before the circuit court and ultimately this court and say this claim should be barred as a matter of public policy, even though all of the elements of liability are met, because this claim is too stale, because this enters appeals with no reasonable stopping point, because it is unfair that this defendant bears a burden. We're not here on that. We're not here to speculate on what prejudice these particular defendants believe they've suffered, if any. They have alleged none for purposes of this motion, and there is no prejudice that this court needs to consider before the court. That will come later if it comes at all.
Counselor, is the position on who is the marker and when the same for a survivor's claim as it is for a wrongful death claim? And let me tell you why I'm asking you this. Wrongful death is purely statutory. In a survivor's claim, all our case law says that the survivor stands in the shoes of the decedent. So if you test their knowledge by the decedent's knowledge in a survivor's claim, I can see a connection, whether that's the one I end up with or not, I don't know. But it would be different if you were looking at a wrongful death claim, because the wrongful death is for those people, it's for the estate of the decedent. It's not really a survivor's claim, so it's not based on whether the decedent suffered before he died or any of those things. Is there any difference, or in your view, is there no difference on who should be the marker?
The marker prior to death appears under Wisconsin law to be the injured party. If the injured party makes a discovery prior to the date of death, then it starts running for both. And there has been disagreement. There was a case in Jenrick before this court in 2009 in the medical malpractice context where the court ultimately came down 4-3 on that being the marker. If the court applies that, as the Court of Appeals did, to the non-medical malpractice in Merrill, then the marker is going to be the same as long as discovery is pre-death. If the discovery is post-death, and what is being argued here is that there can be no discovery post-death because the only person that can discover it is the injured party, assuming that the law is that a person can discover post-death, a claimant can discover post-death, then the wrongful death decedents would be the individual, the wrongful death beneficiaries would be the individuals who would be the markers for a post-death discovery, whereas for the survivorship claim or the survivor claim, it would be the estate or the reasonable person bringing the claim on behalf of the estate. I'd say in most cases they would probably be the same.
So you don't see any difference. It doesn't matter to you that the case law says in a survivor's action,
the claim is the claim of the deceased person. And in a wrongful death, it's for those who survive. You don't think that makes any difference?
I think there is a reasonable argument that was made in Jenrick and was made in Merrill that the wrongful death claimant should have 3 years from the date of death, regardless of when the injury was discovered. That's really not an issue in our case. For our purposes, we're assuming that during the lifetime of the injured party, the injury was not discovered. In a case where it was discovered, I think you can potentially wind up with two different dates of discovery, the date the injured party discovered it and the date the wrongful death claimant discovered it. However, the law is certainly against that interpretation, the medical negligence case, and at least the Court of Appeals law is against that interpretation in a non-medical negligence circumstance.
What the Beaver case, unpublished Court of Appeals case, what should we make of that? The Court of Appeals relied on it. Should we rely on it? It's unpublished.
It's unpublished. It is a parallel case that involves claimants who were exposed to benzene at the Uniroyal factory and the same set of defendants. I realize that it is not something the court will give great weight to. The fact is that the court did not accept a petition for review, and that matter went down under the Court of Appeals interpretation of Wisconsin law, whereas the date of discovery did matter with respect to what the estate or what the wrongful death beneficiaries had. I think the court's analysis in Beaver, wherein it said, you know, you say the only person that matters for the purpose of discovery is the decedent. Show me where in the case law or the statute it says it. Hansen uses the word claimant. Show me where you're pulling this from. And there simply isn't anywhere in the law to pull a distinction between treating the two different types of claims. Hansen discussed the tension that exists, and tension exists in the law between the need for certainty and the need for fairness. And tension exists in statute of limitations cases between that need for certainty and that need for fairness, and that was discussed in Hansen. And Hansen reached a decision, and it pointed out the problems associated with potentially adopting the discovery rule, but it concluded problems caused by the lapse of time needed to be balanced against the policy of allowing diligent claimants to bring meritorious claims. We conclude that the injustice of barring meritorious claims before the claimant knows of the injury outweighs the threat of stale or fraudulent claims. That is the Hansen holding. Hansen did not paint with a fine brush. Hansen said, we're not going to bar meritorious claims that the claimant doesn't know of. And that is what is being sought to be done in this case. Hansen also, while it said there is a common law discovery rule that applies in the absence of a legislatively created one, invited the legislature to create its own discovery rule if it believed one was appropriate, or as this is essentially a statute of repose.
Say that sentence again.
Or as this, the rule advanced by defendants, is essentially a statute of repose. Discovery doesn't matter. 3 years from the date of death, the claims go away. That's what's being proposed here. The legislature has not proposed anything. So there are safety nets. There's the safety net that plaintiffs need to be reasonably diligent, as set forth in Hansen. There is the safety net that plaintiffs need to prove their claim, and if the evidence is stale or the claim is too old, it'll be difficult to do. There is the safety net that there are claims can be dismissed for public policy reasons. And ultimately, there is a safety net of the legislature if it doesn't like what this court did in Hansen as far as a common law discovery rule. It has the power to establish its own rules in this matter. I want to touch on a couple other things. One is that while there is no case law that addresses this issue in the context of a standard common law tort claim, there are a series of medical negligence cases that discuss this exact issue. Those cases are cited in the brief. They're Groom and Ave and Hegarty. And in those cases, claimants brought survival and wrongful death claims more than 3 years after decedent's dates of death. In all three cases, decedents had been unable to discover the claims during their lifetime. All three cases explicitly apply the holding of Hansen, Borrello, and the other common law discovery cases to determine when a claim accrued. The courts specifically looked at the actions of a surviving spouse or parent to determine when the claim accrued and examine factors such as when did they get the medical records, when did they go to a lawyer in order to establish the accrual date. The language in the statutory discovery rule applicable to medical negligence, 893.55(1)(m), is identical to the common law rule. The statute runs from the date the injury was discovered or in the exercise of reasonable diligence should have been discovered, close quote. Claypool, a Wisconsin Supreme Court case, instructs us that the same analysis should be used in common law tort cases and medical negligence cases to determine when discovery accrues. There isn't a reason for treating the holdings of these medical negligence cases on claim accrual different than on any other common law tort claim.
On the issue of accrual, certainly in medical negligence cases, we have a limitation of damages. We have a statute of repose that the legislature built into it.
We have a different statutory scheme, but none of it relates to the date of accrual.
That's right.
And in this case, as I said, in any common law case, the legislature has those abilities if they were concerned about the consequences of Hansen. And evidently, the consequences of Hansen, the negative consequences, have not been so great that they've seen some need to fashion a discovery rule that is more limited than the broad rule this court set forth in Hansen. With respect to wrongful death claims, neither the wrongful death statute, 895.04, nor the relevant statute of limitations, 893.54(2), contain any sort of discovery rule. The Hansen rule applies. The Turbish case, which is cited by defendants, is a 1935 case, which states that wrongful death claim accrues upon death. However, at the time, there wasn't any discovery rule, and there's no discussion of what accrual means post-Hansen in the Turbush case. And since that time, Turbush has not been applied other than discussed in the Jenrick case, in which case it was merely raised for the point of, again, a plaintiff asserting, you know, you should apply this to determine that wrongful death accrues at the time of death because that gives me more time because the injured party knew about the injury during the time period of its life. And the court said, well, notwithstanding whatever may have been said in Turbush, here we have a specific statute which says that, at least in the medical negligence context, claim accrues at the time of injury. And so to the extent that Turbush is good law, it doesn't apply here. And Turbush clearly is not good law. It was not a discovery rule case. It was saying in the absence of a discovery rule, a wrongful death claim accrues upon death.
If I might interrupt you.
You may.
If we would hold your way, are there any cases that we'd have to raise questions about, overturn?
I don't think so, because almost all the cases that are cited, and as I think of them, they're cases like Ruppa and cases like Lord and cases like Merrill. They're not discovery cases. They're disability cases for the most part.
You think Merrill is a disability case?
Well, I don't think it's a disability case, but what it does say is that if the injured individual had knowledge during his or her lifetime, then both wrongful death and survivor claims are eliminated. It raises a hypothetical about what would have happened had those claims not been discovered during the lifetime, but it explicitly says we're not going to decide the issue in the context of this case. So I, while it is not a disability case, it is also not a case that would be altered by this court simply affirming the Hansen rule applies to all claims, all tort claims, including survival claims and including wrongful death claims.
We conclude that the estate survival claim accrued when Merrill, with reasonable diligence, should have discovered his claim here no later than his date of death.
And that's what the court
bothers me. Okay.
That's what the Court of Appeals concluded. And the reason that, first of all, it did not matter because it was filed 3 years from the date of death. So there was no argument that it was found some date later. And the parents who brought this clearly knew about it. So in line with the cases that were cited, like Washington and Santos and Avicula, if the family knew of the claim during the period where the injured party was alive, once they die, at minimum, it starts running at that time.
So you can distinguish Merrill in your opinion.
I believe we can clearly distinguish Merrill.
What about Beaver? Now, in Beaver, does it cite to Merrill?
In Beaver, it cites to Merrill in a footnote. And my recollection is that the footnote is rather dismissive of the argument and does not go into a great deal of detail and said, I believe that the case was raised but not argued or something to that effect. And so while I don't think Beaver necessarily did a thorough analysis of Merrill, it was raised before that court, and I think had it done a thorough analysis of Merrill, Merrill doesn't apply to bar the claims in this matter.
It's in footnote 5. Respondents argue that survival and wrongful death actions accrue at the time of the death, citing Merrill. Respondents do not develop the argument, and so we will not address it further. However, we note that nothing in Merrill precludes the application of a discovery rule. That's how they distinguish Merrill.
That's how they distinguish it. The public policy arguments in this case are no different than the public policy arguments that were raised in Hansen. Defendants propose a rule that would arbitrarily bar claims prior to their discovery. They argue that, for example, Betty Grossfeld shouldn't be able to bring a claim for injuries to her husband, Victor, but that Donald Schindler or Faye Ryder or others who were injured in the same manner, in the same time period, and discovered their claims at the same time can bring a claim. Nothing in the law supports that distinction. Part of the reason I think we're here is that these are difficult facts, but the court is being asked to enunciate a rule that is going to apply to all cases. And if you have someone whose spouse was killed in a hit and run or whose child was killed by a stray bullet and they don't discover the identity of the tortfeasor until 3.5 years after death, through no fault of their own, acting reasonably diligently, that claim is going to be barred. And I suspect if we had a claim on those facts before the court, this case probably wouldn't even be up before the court because people would just take it at face value on those facts. They have until the time of discovery to bring a claim.
So what kind of rule do you want this court to adopt?
I don't want it to adopt any rule. I think the rule is there in place. I want it to apply Hansen.
Okay. Then tell me how you apply Hansen in this case.
And I'll go back to what I said at the beginning.
Right.
I think the application of Hansen provides the
application
following.
Application of the discovery rule. Go ahead.
The application of the discovery rule. If during the injured party's lifetime they discover the claim, that is the date of accrual. It is clearly the date of accrual for a survival claim, and based at least on the Court of Appeals jurisdiction to this point, it is also the date of accrual of any wrongful death claim based on that injury. At the time of death, they have not discovered the claim.
Who's they? The
the injured party had not discovered the claim at the time of their death, then it falls to the knowledge of either the estate, judged on a reasonable person basis, or of the individual wrongful death claimants in terms of when they discovered the claim and whether they were reasonably diligent in discovering the claim when they did. The next moving part would be that if that claim is somehow placing an unreasonable burden on the tortfeasor because the date of discovery is so far out that it is creating the type of problems that were discussed in defendant's hypotheticals, then they can come before the court and make a motion either before trial or after trial that the claim be barred on reasons of public policy. That is what I think the rule is now, and I think that the court should reaffirm that rule in its decision here.
How will you know when, other than if they file a claim, how will you know when the injured party knew before death?
What you're going to have to do is base it on evidence in the record, just as with any other discovery. Is there anything in terms of what he said? Did the injured party consult with a lawyer?
What if someone has asbestosis, but they just don't want to bring a claim?
Sorry, I didn't hear the last part of that.
What if someone has, I'm picking up an injury, what if they have asbestosis? They just don't want to bring a claim. They just don't have an interest in that.
Then
they don't really talk to their family about it. They don't really want to do anything about it. They just want to go peacefully.
Well, then you're saying they don't want to bring a claim. If those are the facts that are proven, if they knew about the potential for a claim and didn't want to bring a claim, then that claim is going to be barred. If those facts are not...
They didn't talk to anyone about it, but they, you know, they knew about it. Their doctor said, you know, we could explore this further. We could look at what's going on in your lungs, but... And the person says, you know what, no, I just don't want to do that.
Then I think what you have is you have the situation that is in Borrello. And if there is objective evidence whereby there is a reasonable belief that they would have had a claim, that is, they know about the injury, they know about the mechanism, the cause of the injury, and they know the potential defendant, that's it. It's too bad. Their decision not to bring a claim forward is...
What if they just don't want to know the potential defendant? They don't want to go through that.
It's judged on a reasonable person basis. If they should have known of the potential for bringing a claim, and for example, I could say, look, in Eau Claire, there were advertisements from lawyers who were advertising for asbestos cases, or look in your medical records. Your doctor said, you know, this is mesothelioma, and I believe that it's caused by workplace exposure. Or you could have something that he potentially or she potentially said. But it's the same as any other type of discovery case that, you know, you could have a person who doesn't want to admit that they knew about it and is alive. And you still have to look at what a reasonable person would have done. What are the facts surrounding it to enable a jury, because it is going to be a fact question in most situations, to determine whether this is something they either knew or reasonably should have known. And that's the same type of analysis that would be done.
How far down the line does it go? If you have medical advances 10 years after death that could find something that you couldn't have found at the time of death, would that be the discovery date?
There is an argument that the discovery rule is somehow going to push claims out to eternity, and it doesn't. Like everything else in tort law, it only goes as far as the facts will reasonably take us. Tort law is all about reasonableness. What is reasonable in terms of the actions of a claimant? What is reasonable in terms of what a defendant should be responsible for? So while you can say hypothetically, you know, gee, there's no bright line, it could be 200 years, the fact is there's enough protections built into the system, enough requirements that all of the actors act reasonably, that those sorts of hypotheticals I don't think will happen, and I think, as Justice Bradley indicated, there isn't an indication that those types of things have happened in other jurisdictions. which have similar statutes and have similar applications to the discovery rule.
Could you clarify for me once more, if you know the cause, but you don't know the defendant, it's 3 years?
I think that you have not discovered it. And when I say know the defendant, I'm talking about the Borrello test, which you can't stick your head in the sand. But, you know, as I was saying, a hit and run, you know your loved one was hit by a car, you know that driver was negligent, but you don't know the driver, your statute of limitation hasn't accrued. So that would be a similar...
Has not accrued.
Has not accrued until you have a claim capable of present enforcement, and if through reasonable diligence you're still unaware of the identity of the defendant, you don't have a claim that's capable of reasonable present enforcement.
I think I misunderstood you. There's if you know there's a hit and run driver,
correct,
you don't somehow discover who that is for 20 years, you still have a claim?
You would, or at 3.5. I shouldn't say you still have a claim. You still have the opportunity to go to court, and if you were reasonably diligent, and if there are not public policy factors precluding bringing the claim, you have the ability to bring a claim. So it's not that you have a right to bring a claim, it's that you are not automatically barred from the court in trying to prove up your claim.
Can you just tell me, in this case, can you add a little more to what the facts were here, what it was that was discovered here after the three-year time period that it's clear it couldn't have been discovered before?
And I will do my best. I will point out that that isn't relevant to the court's decision because it is assuming, both as Judge Stark did, that these claims were discovered in 2006 and that no matter how reasonable or unreasonable it was, they could not have been discovered prior to that date. In essence, what it is that certain people became aware that there seemed to be an unusually large number of cancer cases with Eau Claire individuals, and eventually some of them went to counsel that specialized in benzene cases based on the research that they had done. And once that happened, word spread through the community because it is a relatively small community, and the community of tire workers is a relatively tight-knit community. And so that's sort of the genesis of how this thing happened. And, you know, the people that did the discovery were people that had the cancer. You know, the people who had lost loved ones had kind of set that aside, and that's in the past and moved on with their lives. So it was the people that had the cancer that, you know, how did I get this? What can I do about it? They were the ones that really took the lead and discovered the link for the entire community. I see that my time is up. Unless there's any further questions, thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Sullivan.
Getting to Justice Ziegler's question, that none of the facts that Mr. Biegert has just talked about are part of the record. And the plaintiffs in this case did provide affidavits in response to the motion for summary judgment, the statute of limitations motion. And what they said was they discovered the claims in 2006 when a lawyer told them about them. That's what is in the record in this case. So there's nothing in those affidavits that says anything about what we tried to do to try to discover the claim. There's nothing in those affidavits that says anything about what amount of diligence they had exercised in trying to discover the claim. What those affidavits say is that a lawyer told me about the claim and that's when I discovered it. Let me address the Chief's question about holdings, and let me get that out before my time runs out. What I believe the holdings in this case should be are that a survival claim under 895.01 accrues when the decedent knew or should have known that he was injured, the cause of the injury, and the identity of potential defendants, or on the date of the decedent's death, whichever occurs first. And that is the holding in Merrill. And if the court were to find otherwise, the court, again, addressing the Chief's question, the court would absolutely be reversing Merrill.
Wouldn't that always mean that whichever occurs first, that it really is 3 years from the date of death?
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, whichever occurs first. I mean, there could be evidence, and I believe that there very well could be evidence that the decedent knew or should have known of the injury well before the date of death. Now, in this case, you know, the time span between diagnosis and death is, in some cases, decades. And so an argument certainly can be made that there was information that could have and should have been known well before the date of death.
And it's perfectly plausible that when the decedent died, he did not know the three factors. And therefore, there's no discovery, so the date of death starts the 3 years running. Correct. That's your argument.
That's my argument.
Right.
And the public policy factors that Mr. Bieger talked about, the legislature has already addressed that. And that's what the statute of limitations is. And the legislature has established what the statute of limitations is. It's not an ad hoc decision that's made in each case depending on factors that are going to be brought up after trial. The legislature has made that decision, and that has to be respected. So the next holding is that the application of the discovery rule in survival claims is limited to the discovery made by the decedent alone and is not extended to third parties such as personal representatives, special administrators, heirs, family members, etc. Number three, wrongful death claims accrue when the decedent knew or should have known of the injury, cause, and identity of defendants or on the date of death, whichever occurs first. Four, when a party, either plaintiff or the defendant, asserts the discovery rule, the burden is on the party to show that that rule applies. And that seems to be the holding in Hansen, which conditioned the application of the discovery rule on diligence.
Well, just a minute. But that discovery rule never applies to third parties. It only applies to the decedent.
Correct.
In your interpretation.
That's
okay.
Correct.
That's how you mesh it with one, two, and three.
Right, right. Okay. And for all the reasons we've cited in our brief, because it's unmanageable, it's simply unmanageable to do it any other way.
All right. What's five?
Five is to reaffirm the holding in RUPA that wrongful death claims are derivative. That this court and the Court of Appeals has said many times that wrongful death claims are derivative, and I understand that there has been a discussion about labels and what's derivative and not derivative, et cetera, but the wrongful death as a derivative claim seems to always be brought up as the example of what is a derivative claim.
And who does it derive from?
The person who's injured.
All right. And what does that do for you? What doesn't do for you?
Well, it establishes that the focus is on the person who's injured. In the case of a wrongful death claim, the focus is on the decedent. And I mean, that seems to have been the decision that was discussed in RUPA. And I think that that holding should be reaffirmed, or it would be naturally if the other holdings are. My time's up. I don't know if
you can finish your sentence.
I don't have anything else to say other than my other holdings, but
good. Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Hearing none, I want to thank you, Mr. Sullivan, and you, Mr. Bieger, about your briefs and your discussions today about wrongful death and survival and discovery, all issues that have come to the court before, but in a different context and the configuration of all the elements. So thank you oath, and that concludes our hearing in 2012 AP 1493, Christ versus ExxonMobil Corporation. The court will meet in closed conference. I show 2:40, so that would be 10 after 3. And the court is in recess until tomorrow morning when it has two oral arguments. We are in recess.